This is Bryce Knights and the Breakfast of Champions. And sometimes when you bite into your cereal and a stun wood comes into your mouth, there's only one thing to do. And that's pick up your stun wood and get ill.
Down the hill from Fort Miley on the corner of 43rd Avenue in San Francisco, I'm Schmitty, and this is Talkin' Schmidt. Today on the show is the triple OG, Mr. Bryce Knights. To say Bryce is a major influence on me would be a major understatement. He was pro for Schmidt Sticks, and his model was one I rode more so than most other board. He was photo editor at Thrasher, the magazine I've worked at for 20 years. He brought a copy of the first Thrasher video to my crib to watch before it came out. And he was born and raised in my favorite city in the world, San Francisco. And through those years, he has always had a mystical relationship with the number 43.
It's a number that Orb maps to the skaters' homes, Animal Chin, Rob. I guess he bought a banana at a corner grocery store up on Stanion Street. There was a Middle Eastern guy behind the counter, and he only had 40 cents, but the guy was adamant about the banana being 43 cents. He's like, 43. And it just stuck in Rob's brain, and then everything just became 43. And just everything was 43, and you look at your watch, it was 9:43. A receipt on a bill was something 43. It was just coincidental. Yeah. And it starts fucking with your mind.
Also, please be sure to leave a review and a 5-star rating for our podcast so that it can continue to grow. And if you're looking to help support the show, you can go to talkinschmidt.com, where we have a new long sleeve t-shirt designed by Nasty Neckface, along with the OG logo tees, beanies, and Zorro screened hats. This is episode 43, and they are all free, so what's a $20 purchase, right? Anyways, I was really honored to get to talk with Bryce about his pioneer days and rich history, so without further ado, here's the mighty BK.
This is Bryce Knights, and you're listening to Talkin' Schmidt.
It's cool, like tonight is the night.
Here we go again.
Just give it the old college try, right now.
Oh, big dog's in.
What do you think, Schmitty?
96 times, Schmitty.
Thanks, Schmitty.
We on? Schmitty?
Talkin' Schmidt.
He's so fucking busy.
He shit my pants, lad.
Your Rolodex is fucking deep.
Are you ready?
Come on, Smith.
Let's hear it for Greg Smith.
Yeah! Hello, it is episode 43. And who the fuck else would I have in here but Bryce Knight? What's up, Bryce?
How you doing, Schmitty?
Good. Thanks for coming in. Yeah. Super stoked.
Good to be back in the city for a little bit.
What are you here for?
I rarely get any time these days to just do personal things, like seeing my mother who still lives here. So I came down to see her for a week. I'm always on the road through the spring and fall. I just really don't have much time off. And it's rare these days that I get to come to San Francisco. So.
Oh.
I said, I'm going to make a road trip, and came down with my dog, and we're staying at my mom's house for the week, hanging out with her, doing some, chores and errands for her.
Yeah.
Help her out.
Some family time.
Yeah.
Sick. You were born and raised in SF, obviously.
Yes, I was.
What hospital?
Up on Parnassus. It used to be, I think, called UC San Francisco, UCSF.
Oh.
That's where I was born. My dad was actually down the hill at Kezar Stadium watching a 49ers game. And somehow one of his buddies said, your wife just went in labor. You got to get up the hill to the hospital. So he left the game and met the ambulance and saw me delivered.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Was he into baseball?
He was into baseball, but I think he was more of a football guy. He played jazz music.
Okay.
He was a jazz musician, played bass, and... he was a Niners guy.
Sick.
Yeah, definitely a Niners guy.
And they played at Kezar, and the Giants played like where the Petrero Center is.
Correct.
Yeah, that's so rad. I was there. I seen Willie Mays.
Some OG stuff.
Yeah. And then when did you kind of get into skateboarding? Like, what was your first?
I remember the actual month. It was July 5th after the 4th of July. I was down in Ventura, California, which is down by Oxnard.
Yeah.
And I used to take the train down there in the summertime to see my cousins. And they had picked up skateboarding. And I kind of got attracted to it, bought a skateboard at a surf shop down there, William Dennis Surfboards. And we started skating around the schoolyards and down some hills. And I brought that skateboard back with me 3 weeks later to San Francisco. And from there, I met, you know, Tony and Tommy Guerrero and Ray Meyer and Joe Fong. It all started connecting, you know, within that next 6 months.
Really?
Yeah.
Whoa. So what was that board?
It was a Bane fiberglass 24-inch skateboard with Chicago trucks and loose ball bearing Cadillac wheels. First urethane wheels. So I never rode steel wheels or clay. That was never my experience. I always started on urethane.
And what age were you about?
I was 12.
12. Was there skate shops in SF at that time?
There were very few. There was one down in the Marina District called SF Comp.
Uh-huh.
And then there was Skateboard City, which was on Terravelle and 18th. And I think shortly after that, maybe a year later, was Skates on Haight on Upper Haight Street.
Right.
Which was Skateboard City, was owned by Lee Cole, who then opened the bigger store, which was Skates on Haight.
Okay.
So that was like the late 70s, like 78, I'd say.
So how would you meet like Tommy and Joe and other skaters?
You would see flyers around, and there was some Cal Precision Skateboards was another skate shop that opened up at 9th and Judah. And they had team tryouts at Jefferson Middle School on Irving and 19th. Team tryouts to try out for the skate team of the shop.
Was that like slalom or?
No, it was freestyle. Like doing tricks, you know, kind of flatland stuff. And Tony and Tommy made the team right away, and so did Ray Meyer for doing freestyle. And then we used to ride the hills of San Francisco, the avenues, take the 6 Parnassus up the hill and ride down 9th and 10th and 11th Avenues and use the transfer as basically a lift ticket all day.
Right.
You just have a transfer, and you just show the driver, and you keep going up and down, just doing laps.
Who turned you on to that?
Joe Fong and I think Tony and Tommy Guerrero. I mean, it all...
Living up there? Or?
Well, Tony and Tommy lived on 17th Avenue, right by Judah. So that's where I first met those guys.
How cool.
Yeah, we were all super... Tommy was 9, I was 12, Tony was 12. Joe Fong was the older brother. He was like 4 years older, and he was the first guy to get a car and drove us around to the skate parks when those started popping up, the early skate parks in the late 70s.
Would that have been Winchester? Or?
Yeah, Winchester and Campbell and Milpitas, the first Milpitas.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we got around either by BART, which we can go down to Fremont and then catch the Samtrans bus to Milpitas. And we do that repeatedly every weekend, met friends down there. And then Joe Fong would drive down the peninsula, and we'd go down to the Belmont Drop, which was a ditch down there, and then further down to Campbell Skate Park and Winchester and San Jose, because the only way to get down that way was Caltrain. But we didn't take the train. We wanted a car.
So. The Belmont Drop was the spillway.
Correct.
41st up from Ghost Gate.
Correct.
That was the first place I ever went. I bought my skateboard at Ghost Gate on 41st. And they're like, hey, there's a spillway. We called it the spillway.
Yeah.
Went up there, and they had the little ramps and stuff to it.
Yeah.
There was something else with somebody buttboarding down it, I think jumping some boards. And we're like, that's our spot.
Yes.
Yeah, like the Ox, a bunch of us skated that.
We called that the Belmont Drop.
Oh, sick.
But yeah, the spillway.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rad.
So Joe Fong was our connection to get around, being that he was old enough to drive a car and we were still too young.
Damn. Shout out to Joe Fong.
Yeah, shout out.
Definitely a shout out. He was our older brother that got us around.
He's the hype man. He's
still the cheerleader of skateboarding.
Yeah. He's always texting me, Schmitty, this is coming up. Like, da da da. I'm like, yes.
Yep.
True or false, you were in a punk band?
That would be true.
How did that start?
Well,
was that in high school?
No, that was a little bit after high school, I think. 19. Skateboarding had fallen away. The skate parks went out of business, and skateboarding was just kind of fading away. So what did we do? We got into music and we started playing music, and punk rock was the way to kind of let that expression out. We didn't put our skateboards away totally, but we didn't buy new skateboards. We just used them to get around to the liquor store or, you know, different scenes, but we weren't actively skateboarding for a year. So we got into music, and that being me and Tony and Tommy Guerrero and Dan McGee, Shroogi, a bunch of us just started getting into punk rock because that was the thing to do. And this was 1978 and 79.
Wow.
More towards 79 into 80. And we started a band called Jerry's Kids. I played bass. Tommy played guitar. He sang. Tony played guitar and drums. We didn't know what we were doing. We were just making noise. Made a few songs, and then from there, we dissolved that band. I went to a band called Crucifix, which recorded an EP, and then Free Beer and Revenge started with the Guerrero brothers, and Shroogi was singing with Revenge. So it all came organically. None of us were trained with music. We just loved doing it and loved playing.
Was JFA around?
Yeah, they were. Okay. Yeah, JFA was around at that point.
But this is before the Mag.
Definitely before Thrasher.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Wow.
This was probably a year before Thrasher started.
That's insane.
And we used to go down to Mabuhay Gardens and see all the shows with Black Flag and Dead Kennedys. And we, you know, soon enough, we were playing support for those bands.
Yeah.
And, you know, opening up for the Dead Kennedys or the Lude or Circle Jerks. And we have all the handbills. Like, we were there. We were part of that whole scene.
That's
up.
Amazing.
You know, going to shows for like $5 or less, you know, it was great.
Do you remember like any specific that was like all time? Like my brain would be like, we played with Bad Brains, but like, you know.
Well, Free Beer did play with Bad Brains.
Wow.
Yeah, at the Fillmore Hall.
Oh,
right,
wow.
There on Geary Street. Free Beer went pretty far.
Yeah.
I mean, I played in a band for a year with Crucifix, and then I just got out of it, got back into skateboarding more and more, as did Tony and Tommy eventually. But no, Free Beer went far. They recorded on Not So Quiet on the Western Front. Uh-huh. It was put out by Jello and his crew, and they played a lot of shows. I think they went all the way down to L.A. a couple of times. Yeah. So, I mean, Free Beer did really, really well. You know, Tony and Tommy really became great musicians, as you know.
Yeah.
They're both doing it really well, so.
Yeah.
Totally self-trained, self-taught.
Somehow those brothers do everything they do well.
Style, man. It matters.
Yeah. So then how did getting sponsored come along?
That was like just, again, none of us really said, oh, we're going to be sponsored skateboarders, or, you know, we had this goal to be pro. There was really like no industry at that point. We were just skating around. Street skating started happening with Thrasher's support, and Stacy Peralta and Fausto and Kevin, KT, got together, and they put together the first street skate contest in 1983 in Golden Gate Park.
Huh.
And there was a couple of bank ramps. I believe there's a wedge ramp and a few fly-off ramps and maybe a flat bar. It was really ramshackle, but it happened. It went off great. Tommy won, but he couldn't take the money because he was an amateur. So Christian Hassoy won because he got second, but he was a pro. And Tommy was super pissed and crying, and it was pretty dramatic. But that was the first street skate contest ever. We all had fun. It was good. It showed where things could go. And from that point forward, we just started skating around the city and like had it in our brains and our eyes like, That's skatable. And we would go around downtown San Francisco and out to Fort Miley and all these spots and find places to skate.
Yeah.
And this is like before anybody was doing it. We're before kickflips, but we were doing boneless ones and tail slides and lip slides.
Yeah.
You know, anything that was a basic ollie trick, we were doing that.
Uh-huh.
And Archimedes comes up one day. He's like, dude, I got this spot on the bridge. Took us down to Geary Street. Right there at Portsmouth Square, and that's China Banks.
Oh.
And Arco showed us China Banks.
Sick.
It's still there today.
Yeah.
Whew. Yeah, so we were discovering new spots every day, every week. It was just new terrain.
Would you go ride the EMB, the wave thing?
Yep. Yeah. Yep. We'd ride the wave, EMB. There were some banks on Second and Howard, the brick banks.
Oh, yeah.
And they used to not have any stoppers on them. You could wall ride onto the building, which we did plenty of times. Back to being sponsored, it just happened because the industry grew as we were all growing. Mm-hmm. And then brands needed riders to support their gear and sell their gear. So we started getting sponsored in the 80s. Back to the 70s, and Tony and Tommy were sponsored by a board brand called Alotaflex, which was in Berkeley, California. Those guys were the Groms on the team for a bit. And then, of course, the 70s and the skate parks all collapsed, and that went away. So Tony and Tommy were sponsored back then, that young. But then there was a void for about a year and a half, and then skateboarding came back as we were playing punk rock music. And then Tommy got sponsored by Madrid, and then he got sponsored by Independent through Fausto. Tommy was on Madrid for maybe 6 months, and then I got noticed by Madrid. And as soon as I was on Madrid, or right after Tommy left, that's when I got on Madrid and Tommy went to Pal Peralta.
We were never
teammates on Madrid.
Okay.
But we were so stoked for Tommy because he got noticed by Stacy, and
that was a big deal.
He was the guy. He was the street component to the Vert guys that they already had.
Right.
So he made up the final person, I guess, so to speak, for the Bones Brigade. And that's, you know, San Francisco blood right there. So,
yeah, he put us up on the map.
Fuck yeah.
And do you think that was a big part of Thrasher's growth too?
Definitely.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like Pal Peralta had its hands in Thrasher's business, but it was so small back then that everybody worked together to build this industry. Right. And as I remember, when I first started working in this building, it's actually in the shipyard, but everybody worked together. And Fausto and Stesic and Stacy, Novak, they all wanted to push skateboarding. They wanted to sell their products. They wanted to manufacture their products. Yeah. So they would take the roadshow to Nebraska and go to Rich Flowerday's backyard ramp and hold a contest. Put it in the mag, hype it up. Same thing at Joe Lopes' ramp.
Right.
Bring all the guys up here, have a contest. The first jam ever. Put it in the mag, hype it up. Then they started to do that with street skating. Capitola Classic.
Yeah.
Have an event, hype it up. So it was all self-controlled, but you know, to build skateboarding. It wasn't just for Thrasher.
Right.
But it was, because Thrasher was the only name in the game at that point, you know?
Yeah, if you look
Trans World came like 3 years later.
Oh, okay.
After the mag started.
83. If you look at those old videos, Fausto's in all of them. Like, he's on the side, or he's talking to, like, Christian or whoever.
He made shit happen, man.
Yeah.
He was like, this is how it's going to go down. These guys are going to get paid this, and we're going to have a contest. And we're going to hype it in the mag.
Is that kind of when you started getting interested into photography and trying to get in with, like, how did that happen where you started working at Thrasher?
Well,
or were you shooting photos your whole life?
As a kid, I had been shooting since I was about 12, but it was just a hobby thing. It wasn't like I had no desires to be a pro photographer or a pro skater. I just, just did it because I saw cool photos in skate mags and other magazines I saw. So I always carried a camera with me wherever I went, thankfully. So I have a lot of this stuff documented. One day I was at Rainbow Skateboard Shop, which was on Stanion Street, and Kevin Thatcher came in, and we were talking, and he had known, like, Don Fisher and Chris Cook and some of those guys who were in the shop. And then I got introduced somehow to Kevin, and I showed him my prints that I had printed in my Photoshop class in high school. And he really liked this photo that I had printed of Camden Scott hanging upside down on the BART train on the bars with his feet and his skateboard on his feet upside down.
Uh-huh.
Got used as a something else.
Right.
Maybe a month after that, Kevin told me that the magazine was growing. We could really use someone in the darkroom to help work with production and grow with us. So I quit my barbecue job, which I was working. It was pretty hard. It was a pretty greasy job. I quit that and started working at the magazine as the first paid intern, basically, and just learning from KT, Fausto, and Mofo.
Yeah.
How to put a magazine together, how to blow it, how to sweep floors, how to screen T-shirts, all that stuff. I was just learning as the magazine grew. I was with it too.
So sick. What was the barbecue place? Was it like a restaurant or something?
It was called Firehouse Barbecue on 6th and Clement Street. It was owned by a San Francisco fireman named Carl. And I was there for a year and a half. So I used to cook ribs and chicken and links. And
hence your epic barbecue skills.
I can cook. I can definitely cook.
Right.
So I did that and then went to the magazine and worked at the mag while I also went part-time to City College for print technology, just learning paste up and layout, which I did at the magazine as well before desktop publishing. So just cutting Ruby lists and overlays and hands-on mechanicals to layout magazines.
Yeah, it was like gluing stuff.
Yeah, a lot of hot wax and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And X-Acto knives and tape and a lot of prep.
You would do Photoshop skills without Photoshop. Like, you would still put the guy over a logo, or like the cover.
Yeah, the cover logo would go over Lester Kasai blasting a back to air.
Yeah. But you would just cut it with an X-Acto knife.
All done by hand.
Right. That's insane.
Hand skills and lots of herb.
Yeah.
There was a lot of that going on, too. Just there was a lot of, I don't know, there was no kind of HR department at high speed at that point.
Right. I'm sure that time clock wasn't there either.
No.
Did you sit in on an interview? What was the process? Like, did you have to come in and sit down and be
No interview. I mean, KT told me
I had, you're hired?
He loved what I stood for and what I was doing and said you could really use someone like me. And then from that point, I met Fausto and Eric, and they were great, cool guys. I mean, they just saw me as a young kid that was hungry, you know.
Right.
It wasn't a formal interview at all.
Uh-huh.
And I just started hanging out with those guys, and I'd hear all their jokes and their shit talk, and it was awesome. It's like having older brothers or dads in the room, you know.
Yeah.
And you just jive with them. So.
But at that time, they hadn't really laid down anything. Like, this was all new. So it wasn't like...
The magazine was new. The manufacturing business, which was across the street, was where they made the trucks, Ermico. Uh-huh. So they knew how to pour metal and make trucks. And so that was their business. But they wanted to, you know, grow that business. They had to have a magazine to push those products.
Sure.
But hearing their, you know, daily banter about stuff was pretty cool.
I can only imagine.
Shit talk about stuff and motorcycle parts, just all kinds of stuff.
Right.
It was great.
Was Ed involved?
Ed was involved too.
Yeah,
but he was kind of not on, he wasn't in the office all the time at that point. He came in later when we moved to this building here on Underwood Avenue in 1988. We did the big move.
So was your first published photo the Something Else?
It was, yeah, Something Else.
Rad. Of Camden.
Of Camden Scott. Yeah.
No way, that's cool.
Yeah, we'll have to put it on the Talkin' Schmidt site.
What about first cover?
First cover. Man, there's been so many, it's hard to remember the first. But I think it was Brian Brannon at the Love Bowl, that big psych that was outdoors, that Jaws and everybody skated.
Yeah, yeah, in Arizona.
I think it was Brian Brannon at the Love Bowl in 1987.
Oh.
Yeah, color cover.
Rad.
I think that was the first one. And then when I got the cover... was like I had been working here for about a year and a half, and I was skating a half pipe contest in Mill Valley, and me and, you know, Ken Takeda and Tommy Guerrero and Sasha Steinhorst and Jake Phelps and so many people were there skating. We were all the hot amateurs back then. And KT shows up. He's like, hey, what's up, rad contest. He was like all hype man. He walks up to me and gives me the new mag right in front of me, and we're in the middle of practice. I look at the mag and it's me on the cover. I'm like, you son of a bitch. He totally surprised me. I had no idea. I had helped put that magazine together, but didn't see the cover.
Whoa.
I was just floored.
Damn. That's
thanks,
some,
KT. That's
shout out.
That was a life hammer. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was pretty stoked.
And was that drawing the Pusshead one modeled after you?
On, yes.
Like the, a nose pick?
Yeah,
on
the fire pick.
Right.
So I think Fausto and Pusshead talked about a concept for an art cover.
Yeah.
And Pusshead got the okay from Fausto, and then he said, hey, I want you to do that nose pick trick that you do, because I came up with the nose pick. So we just did a nose pick, ollie nose pick on this curb up in the Mission, on 25th and Mission, in an alleyway. I think Luke took it, and then Puss illustrated it.
Sick.
With the Jordans on.
Damn.
And it was called the fire pick. I've had two covers, I guess.
Do you remember what happened the year there was no June issue?
You know, I remember there was something wrong with the printer. We used to get the magazine printed, and this was one of my other parts of my job. We used to print up at the Clear Lake Observer, which was a newspaper up in Clear Lake, California. It's like, you know, 2.5 hours from here. And the connection was Ed Riggins had a friend or somebody that he grew up with that owned the Clear Lake Observer. So that's where the first newsprint magazines were printed.
Oh.
In Clear Lake.
Damn.
So I would rent a U-Haul every month and go pick up all the magazines. I'd drive an empty U-Haul up to Clear Lake, fill it up Sick. With all the mags, and drive it back to the shipyard. And then offload them into the warehouse every month. I would do that. So I think there was a problem with the printer up there, and we decided we couldn't do a mag. I can't remember what the real reason was, but there was some kind of a production problem with the printing.
Okay.
And there was a Stacy Peralta May, June.
In 86, there was an October, November issue that was
this
like...
this is way before then. I'm totally mistaken then. I want to say it's 84.
Oh, okay.
It's a yellow cover with Stacy Peralta.
Oh, maybe early 80s?
Yeah, it's a double issue.
Okay. Well, because that was what I was going to ask next, is in 86, there was an October, November issue. So there was only 11 issues that year.
Is that with Hawk at the Pink Motel pool?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the next year, there was 13 issues because one of them was called the winter issue. And so I was wondering...
Like you're scrambling my brain.
I'm claiming that's the first 13, because later we would do 13
Correct.
Issues and call them 13.
13, right.
But this one was just said winter 88, and then there was January through December also, okay. So there was 13 issues that
I've
year.
I've got to go back to my archive now, because I have every single Thrasher. I mean, there's no way.
As well as do I. We got to talk about Tommy and that session at Alcatraz.
Ah,
it's so iconic.
The famous Alcatraz session.
I'm sure that's one of the things you...
I just saw John Detman, John Little, his former last name Detman, but John Little now lives in Utah. So John was working out at Alcatraz for the U.S. Park Service, and he was just one of the general rangers. You know, he wasn't a tour guide or anything, but he worked there for several months. And he's a skater from Santa Barbara, and he knew most of us here in the city skating, skated my ramp, skated HP ramp, all that stuff. But he came here to work at High Speed.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually the first team manager for Independent Trucks under Fausto. So John was working here in this building, and he mentioned this wall that was pretty low with a tight tranny on it in the prisoner's workout yard on Alcatraz. And he was saying, well, I think I can swing it where we can go out there and get a photo shoot. It'd be rad, you know, go skate Alcatraz. And so I think KT said, yeah, go for it. Let's see if we can make that happen. And it did. We got permission to do a photo shoot on Alcatraz. And we went out with the employees on the first ferry out of Fisherman's Wharf to the Alcatraz Island. And got that out there in the morning. And we rented a costume, a prisoner's costume, striped, you know, zebra stripes. It was Gons and Tommy Guerrero, that is, myself, Kevin Thatcher, and John Detman. And we get out there and we meet John's former co-workers, and this one woman decided she'd take us around and show us the cell blocks and all that, and she let us, you know, skate down what's called Broadway, which is the main cell block.
Uh-huh.
And we could skate down Broadway and got a few shots, I think KT did, of John in the prisoner uniform. And then I got a few shots of John laying down in one of the cell blocks with the prisoner uniform. And then we went out to the recreation yard. And the woman who was with us, she got a call on her radio and she had to go, you know, meet someone else. And she said she'd come back. So we're out there in the prisoner's yard and Gons is looking at the wall. He's like, oh, that's totally skatable. So he starts doing these like wallies up to pivot and coming in. He did a disaster, frontside disaster. And I shot maybe 8-10 shots and she came back. And she was kind of pissed. She's like, you guys weren't supposed to skate. Well, we have skateboards. She's like, no, this was supposed to be just like a fashion thing. You're damaging the yard. You know, this is a national historic monument.
Right.
So we got kicked off the island. She told us we had to leave.
Damn.
So I think all told, KT shot two rolls of black and white, and I shot one roll of color and one roll of black and white. That was it.
I got that photo on my wall.
Yeah. So we were on the island maybe 4 hours. On and off.
Damn.
It happened so quick.
Uh-huh.
And that was that.
Wow. Okay. This is the 43rd question. What is the deal with the number 43?
Well, 43, it doesn't come from me originally, obviously. It's a number that Orb, Maps to the Skater's Homes, Animal Chin, Rob. Rob's a good friend of all of us growing up. Rob Fladen, Rob Cam. He's got two last names as well. I guess he bought a banana at a corner grocery store up on Stanion Street. There was a Middle Eastern guy behind the counter, and he only had 40 cents, but the guy was adamant about the banana being 43 cents. He's like, 43, 43, 43. And it just stuck in Rob's brain, and then everything just became 43. And that was like early 80s. It was just like 43, 43. And it was an inside joke with all of us.
Uh-huh.
And just everything was 43. And you look at your watch, it was 9:43. Receipt on a bill was something 43. And it just was, it became not good luck or bad luck. It was just coincidental.
Yeah.
And it starts fucking with your mind. In fact, Neil Blender came up to me one time at a contest. He's like, man, I wish I never knew about that number because now I just see 43 everywhere. It's fucked.
Uh-huh.
So if you're clued into 43, you're going to see it.
Yeah.
And that's the cult of 43.
Damn.
San Jose had a 22 thing going on. I don't think it ever really caught, but Ray Stevens and Cab and all those guys will tell you otherwise, but
uh-huh.
43 is it.
Fuck.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, and it became this cult thing. And it's,
yeah, we all...
People all over the world know about 43.
Yeah, we all took a piece of it.
Yeah.
I remember a friend of mine in high school, he was like, 47.
Okay.
He's like, this is my version.
Right.
But anytime I see 43, I always...
And it's a prime number. Not divisible. I mean, there's reasons for it, and you can look at certain newspaper headlines, and it's like, the Night Stalker killed 43 people, or it just, things come up. It's just really weird.
Right.
So, 43 will always be part of me and others.
Do we know where Avalon is these days? Ask Avalon, do we know what...
Wow, that was a KT connection.
Oh.
And... As a young 20-something man, I thought she was hot.
Uh-huh.
I met her once.
Oh.
But I have no idea where she is. I think that answer probably lives with KT or Blackheart, perhaps.
Oh, yeah, they might know.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to get a hold of her these days.
That's a good one. I know where Uncle Burley is.
Yeah. He's back at shipping, killing it. What about, did you get flack for the snowboard cover?
Here and there I have.
Yeah.
Like, how dare you?
Yeah.
Thrasher is not a snowboard magazine.
Right.
I used to help KT in the early 90s. He was trying to bring in some snowboarding, I think more for advertisers. Truth be told, there were a lot of skateboarders that did snowboard, including myself.
Yeah.
So we did this feature every month called Cold Snap.
Mm-hmm.
And either myself or other snowboard photographers like Rob Mathis or
Scott Starr.
There were a lot of other snow photographers out there that we would have contribute. And I thought it was cool for a while until the snowboard industry got gooned out by corporations. So it became, K2 and Head and all these ski companies buying into snowboarding. So it just ruined it. It just didn't have that same feeling of just organically growing a snowboard industry like Thrasher did with skateboarding.
Do we have anything to worry about skateboarding, that happening to skateboarding with the Olympics and everything?
It could happen, man.
Yeah.
It could happen. We really, I mentioned on my Instagram to Jake yesterday, just Felper, like I miss his honesty, and just he didn't give a fuck what people thought. If he felt it was right, he was going to say it and speak his mind.
Yeah.
And I think we're missing that in skateboarding. A lot of people are scared to say something. They don't want to make waves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? It's time to make waves or we're going to lose what we got.
We need Olsen.
Yeah. I wish Felper was around to see what's going to go down with this Olympics thing.
Yeah.
I wish he was in Japan pushing buttons.
Uh-huh. Meeting Jake for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Yeah. He was this standoffish, quiet guy that just showed up to Joe Lopes' ramp one time. He had a thick sweater on. It was really hot out.
Huh.
and he was ripping on a longboard, like ripping, and had like, I don't know, maple syrup in his hair or something, just sticking up all spiked. He was a punker from Boston, and he just showed up and started ripping with us. I don't know where he came from or how he got to SF. I think he had family here. I'm not sure.
Huh.
So he would show up, be around for like a year, and then be gone. And okay. Show up again. Then he started working at Concrete Jungle.
Yeah.
Which was a skate shop in Upper Haight.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was in the city full-time from that point forward, like 1986. And he worked with Tommy Guerrero and Mike Johnson and Archimedes, a bunch of guys at the shop. And more was involved with the scene.
Do you think that's where he learned? Because when you work at a skate shop, it's kind of natural to vibe people.
Yeah.
Do you think, like you said, he was quiet. Is that or was he had that instilled in him already?
I think he learned that
at the skate shop,
punk rock shows, and at the skate shop. Uh-huh. Yeah, just being edgy. You know?
Interesting.
Yeah, I think he didn't learn that. He just grew into that.
Sure.
You know, he became this voice and this attitude, and people listened to him. Some people were terrified of him. You know,
like and didn't want to talk to him. And confidence.
Yeah.
Gained, like Fausto giving him that chance or whatever was like, oh, okay.
Well, here's what happened. You know, I worked under Kevin Thatcher for many years here, and then street skating really took over, and Vert died. It did die in 92. And Jake was working here in the shipping department, him and Sarge just shipping out boxes, all the products, you know, all the shirts that you've seen for decades, they were doing it. Mm. And Jake knew the difference between a heel flip and a kick flip and all the technical tricks. And KT had lost that, and Mofo didn't have a sight on what was going on. There was a lot of changes going on in skateboarding, especially in the streets. And Jake kept his ears and eyes to it, and he proved that he knew what was going on, and Fausto saw that. Mm. So Jake moved up into the editorial department with myself, and Ken McGuire was still there, and Brian Brannon, who was our music director turned art director. So for a number of years, it was me and Brannon and Jake running the magazine.
KT was gone?
He was into a publisher role with Ed.
Okay.
So he wasn't really eyes on or what's going in the mag. It was more about me and Jake and Brian putting it together.
Huh.
Kevin still had some insight to it, but Jake was leading more of the eyes of what's going on. We're going to do this trip. We're going to do this trip.
Right.
Things like that. He knew what was going on in skateboarding, and he cared. It was good for Thrasher at that point, and the industry was kind of fucked. A lot of guys turned pro, and they were gone. Blaze blowing.
Yeah.
1 year in, 1 year out.
Yeah.
Mike Yosefor.
Fedge.
It just happened. It was unfortunate, you know. These guys got their pro model, gone.
Yeah.
Next, street skating.
Yep.
And everything was super slow, and we were blowing through so much film trying to shoot sequences with film that I would be laying at the bottom of a hubba or something, and there'd be like 20 rolls of empty canisters of film that were just wasted. Not makes, just bales.
Yeah.
And Fausto was freaking out, like, you guys are wasting so much fucking money on film. He was pissed. So what did we do next? We turned to video capture, screen captures, frame by frame of video footage. It was the worst low-res stuff ever. And it was going in the mag, and I hated it as a photographer. It was the worst thing. But you're trying to keep up with what was going on, the progression of skateboarding. So we did that for a number, you know, maybe 2 years, year and a half.
Right.
And thankfully, digital came in much later, but
yeah,
digital saved everything, especially for sequences.
And technical skating, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Some of those mags, the print would come off on your finger, right? Like,
yes.
I feel like now people make more of a deal about that than probably then. Or were people, like, would you send out a mag and somebody be like, nice mag, the ink came out my fingers? Or, like, no, right?
Not really. I think it was just, that's the way it was.
Yeah. I don't think
people were that pissed about
some
it.
Like, nowadays people will be like, the ink doesn't come off anymore. It's like a slag or
that
something.
That was decades ago.
Yeah.
Transworld always had a glossy paper.
So right.
They had the better paper than we did out of the gate.
So the photos look better on that stock.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Was there one cover out of all the Thrasher covers in the time you worked that was kind of like sticks out as one of the worst ones?
Oh, yeah. There's some pretty bad ones. I don't know, man. Like that one of Hosoi flying, doing a method in Italy, and there's no guy in the sky over a beach. I mean, I haven't seen it in years, but I know it's in my brain, and I wish it wasn't, but it's the worst cover I've seen. Like, okay. What the hell is that? It's like a bad postcard. One of the best covers. There's so many.
Uh-huh.
I don't know, man. It goes so far. I mean, I can go 90s. I can go last week, you know.
I'm biased, but I got to go with Phil. Fort Miley.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Over the Bar.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's many groundbreakers.
There's some good Cardiel ones. The Ring of Fire one's pretty sick.
Ring of Fire was pretty good. It was challenging to shoot. Uh-huh. It was all on film. The fire kept going out. We didn't have a gas line through it. It was all done with kerosene and wrapped rope.
Right.
And so Kevin Ansel kept relighting it, and we finally got it right. You know, we didn't have Photoshop back then. We couldn't enhance it, and that would be bullshit to enhance it. So
yeah,
we had to shoot it as is.
That's it.
But Cards pulled it through, and that was like, it was getting darker and darker. It was like, fuck, it was a struggle. my favorite that I think I've shot is probably the Gons at the Widowmaker ramp.
Oh,
on the clay wheel board.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just laying next to the ramp, and Gon started faking back and forth on it. Within 15 minutes, he did a frontside ollie, and I had to shoot a photo of it. It was insane. We didn't have a plan of even shooting that day. I shot him on his regular board doing some stale fishes and eggplants and, you know, just skating with him and Max. Mm-hmm. And then he pulled out that board that was on the side of the ramp and did a frontside ollie.
Did you ever see anybody skate that ramp not see him skate because Jake said you have to roll in and they couldn't, and so they left? Did that
happen? No, I never saw that.
Oh.
But
did that go down?
It did go down.
Okay.
That was the rule.
That was the
rule. You had to roll in.
Right. And that roll ramp in, was gnarly,
get the
right?
fuck out. That is the quote. It always will be. And the same stood for that ramp across the street here.
Yeah.
You got to roll in or you get the fuck out of here. Tough love.
Yeah. I think Burnett told that story that when he got hired, Jake took him to the ramp and said, roll in. And luckily, Mike was kind of a vert skater.
His tranny skills.
Yeah. So he was like, I did it. But
Yeah.
Was there something special about this session, that iconic photo that we used for the cover when he passed at Hunter's Point? I know that was like a big vert ramp in that era for everyone to go to. But was that session in particular, was there anything like kind of cool to know about?
That particular photo wasn't a special session. It was an average, everyday session.
Uh-huh.
It was the HP ramp in Hunter's Point, just on the other side of the hill from the building here.
Right.
And it was all built in this guy Roland Finger's backyard. It's a dilapidated house, but it had a lot of backyard area. So it was all stolen wood that was assembled. And it was an old vert ramp that hung out for like a year and a half.
Was it originally Shroogie's?
It was Shroogie's old ramp from Walnut Creek. And all the wood ended up in Hunter's Point and got rebuilt. Had angle iron, steel angle iron on one side, and then the side where Jake is grinding had a PVC pipe cut in half, and it used to flex and bend and pop up. Nails would pop up through it. It was just sketchy.
Mm-hmm.
But that particular day was just an average day. A lot of guys came from all over the Bay Area to skate that ramp, so you would have a convergence of different guys skating. Crews from Hayward or Mill Valley or, you know, the peninsula, everybody came to that ramp. They just knew about it. And it wasn't like you had to have permission. You just walk on the side of the house and you were in the session.
Yeah, it was like a gnarly zone.
It was a gnarly zone back then. You wouldn't go outside or walk down the street to the store.
Yeah.
It was just too gnarly. Mm-hmm. In fact, Pierre used to live under the extension of the ramp for a number of months. Yeah. Pretty crazy.
And you were you at the contest where they had the riot at the dish?
I threw that contest. It was called the Day of Hell. And I had an idea to put on a contest at the dish. I don't know why I thought that, but I got Smooth Hill to give me, they were a distributor in Mill Valley. They gave me some boards from C-Flex, and I got some boards from Ron at Concrete Jungle, and we had a bullhorn. And we had a street skating kind of contest at the dish, and the Jax team showed up, and
right.
It turned into a riot. And the contest went off, but right towards the end, it just got gnarlier and gnarlier, and more of the locals were showing up and throwing bottles. And all of a sudden, there was a decision to get the fuck out of there because it was getting gnarly. Uh-huh. Like, we didn't hear any gunfire or nothing like that, but it was not a place for us white boys to be.
Yeah.
We got in the cars and got the fuck out of there. Yeah, that was called Day of the Hell. Noah Selaznick won. It was 1985, like in the spring of 85.
Okay.
Yeah.
What year did you turn pro?
1987.
For Madrid. That was the graffiti BK?
Correct. Uh-huh. Yeah, that was the first board I had.
Okay. And then the Gargoyle Schmidt sticks.
Yeah.
What's the story behind that graphic? Is it from a building in SF?
Correct. You've done your homework.
I had about 8 of those boards.
Okay.
That was one of the... Wow. It was like... Because it was kind of shaped like a Nautis. And I skated with dudes that loved Nautis.
Uh-huh.
And we were skating Nautis. But then that one, the pointy nose.
Right.
It was like different. I don't know.
So Nautis and I both had the pointy nosed boards back then.
Yeah.
Those shapes seemed to work really well for wallies.
Right.
Because there's not as much nose drag, so you could glance off the side of the wall and just keep going. So really good for wallies and wall rides for that matter. But the Gargoyle, they are positioned on the southeast corner of 2nd and Bryant Streets. And they're on that building right above the lobby level. And you can see them from outside. And I shot a photo of the Gargoyle with the shield, sent that down to Paul Schmidt. And then he had Chuck Holtz and Jay Henry put the artwork together from my photograph.
Right.
And that's how graphics were done back then. You had an idea, you get it to your sponsor or somebody that can really draw, and that's what happened. And the BK was drawn by Kevin Ansell, who worked here and did the Spitfire logo and all that stuff.
He's done so much.
So he did the BK.
Oh, sick.
Yeah. I did one board graphic before in my life, and that was Joe Lope's first board graphic for Schmidt Sticks.
Really?
It was a MC Escher drawing of a crystal ball. And I shot a photo of Joe Lopes in his bedroom holding a ball. And then I incorporated that into the Escher drawing.
I think
drawing.
I remember so that. Did they make a sticker of it?
Yeah, there's a sticker. And Joe Lopes is holding the crystal ball in his own bedroom with the bong on the dresser and all that.
Yeah.
Joe is a smoker, a big smoker.
Fuck. That's sick.
So.
CBS, when did that start?
Wow. I think it came through this guy who was a boogie boarder skater, Michael Shaw.
Uh-huh.
African-American guy that grew up with us. He was out in the avenues. And he always used to say, CBS, bro, CBS, bro. It was always stood for City Boy Shred.
Right.
And myself, Mickey Reyes, Tommy, Orb, all of us, that was our moniker back then, was CBS. So we were known as the City CBS Boys.
Right.
Wherever we went in a contest or a skate session.
And there was a video called CBS Boys, right? Nope. Like they had the freestyle bike. You're
thinking
guy?
Of...
Curb Dogs.
Curb Dogs.
Yeah, that's
curb
right.
Curb Dogs. Totally separate.
Okay.
Curb Dogs was more BMX based, but it also had some skateboarding in it because the BMX connection to our crew was Maurice Meyer, Ray Meyer's brother, who rode for Skyway.
Oh.
Bikes. And him and Dave Vanderspeck, who used to ride...
That's the guy.
Dave Vanderspeck used to ride BMX at Joe Lopes' ramp.
Right.
Really good.
Yeah, he was...
So
sick.
Both Dave Vanderspeck and Maurice Meyer were riding bikes for Skyway.
Okay.
And so they did a video mainly based on demos and skating, riding at Golden Gate Park, which we used to do every Sunday. We'd haul a jump ramp out there to skate. Those guys would do their freestyle routines on bikes or skateboards. So we always had a crew out in Golden Gate Park every Sunday and just skating. It was fun. And that's where the Curb Dogs guys put their video together and got some notoriety.
Right.
But CBS was a totally different thing.
Okay.
And CBS didn't really go that far. It was just kind of more of an insider thing. But, you know, the Sacto boys knew us and San Jose, CBS.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit. Because there was some heat between SoCal and NorCal skateboarding, right?
Yes.
Like, the first cover was a drawing. Then there was it the second or third cover that the guy from...
Chris Stropel
got. And that was kind of a big deal to have a SoCal guy on a NorCal mag
cover.
Correct.
So here's the thing. Chris Stropel was a tracker skater.
Uh-huh.
And he grew up in Southern California with Wally and all the guys.
Right.
He's a well-known professional skater. And the first guy that did the backside alley-oop air, KT went down there, and Stropel had just gotten onto Indy. So I don't know, and this is Stropel would be able to tell you, but he's on Indy. KT went down there. They shot a photo, several photos of him skating a backyard pool, and that became the first photo cover for Thrasher magazine. Issue prior was an illustration that KT drew.
Right.
Onto Indy. So I don't know, and this is Stropel would be able to tell you, but he's on Indy. KT went down there. They shot a photo, several photos of him skating a backyard pool, and that became the first photo cover for Thrasher magazine, because the issue prior was an illustration that KT drew.
Right.
So the first photo cover was Chris Stropel from Southern California on Indy trucks.
Right.
Like,
was there a kind of, like, what was the vibe
I
on
was
that?
I wasn't even working at the mag then, so I don't know.
Okay.
But I can sense that ruffled some feathers.
Heavy.
Like, but there was no industry at that point. It was done. Uh-huh. There was one magazine. Nobody was buying skateboards at that point. So it's kind of a tough spot. But again, Thrasher was putting their foot in the ground saying, this is where it's going. This is our guy. We're growing it.
Yeah.
We're taking whoever we want with us. It seemed.
Right. Okay, moving forward a little bit. I saw you in Canada in 1988 at Kevin Harris Skate Park. I don't think we really knew each other at all, but we might have seen each other. But like, I knew, like, oh, there's Bryce. Like, I knew it like that.
Were you on vacation? Or
me and my friend Eric that you met later.
I know,
we graduated from high school, and we took a trip. And
to
we were
ranch.
Like, we got to go skate that ramp place. Like, because it was in Langy outside of Vancouver, and it had all these indoor. It kind of was like Animal Chin on steroids.
Yeah.
And there was just ramps everywhere.
Right.
And we loved ramps.
Right.
So we went there not really knowing what the fuck we were going to do. And you were there with...
I was there with Noel Murphy.
Noel Murphy?
My buddy Noel, yeah.
Okay. And
we were on a vacation. It wasn't a work trip.
I have a photo of you doing a lip slide on a ramp there, though.
Wow.
4 years later, 5 years later, you were maybe tutoring kind of Tobin, like getting him like, hey, there's this new photographer. I'm going to show him the ropes. Tobin somehow comes to San Mateo to like shoot with my friend Mike Alcantar, who was really good, and Oscar Polchowski. Somehow we go to a contest in San Francisco or a jam, and you're like, hey, we're going to go over to this school that, and we're going to do some, we're with McIntyre, we're filming some stuff. Do you guys want to come? We're like, yeah, whoa, this is crazy. So we go there, and that was the day that they did the No Couch Potato Venture ad where Mike's going over. I think it was Mickey, but it might have been Arco.
Mickey and Julian sitting down.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
In front of that school is a handrail.
Correct.
Where Julian did the first front board that same day.
Yep.
It was the session. It was just like
all
happening right in that day. And I was lucky enough to be there. I had a camera. I kind of shot it from behind, and I have photos of possibly one of the first ever frontside boards on a handrail.
You do have a photo of the first front board.
That was insane. And then I think it was like 2 days. It was that weekend. We drove to Tahoe in my VW bus. There was a contest at maybe Donner. And we had a whole great, like Ray Barbie was, there was all these people that I was meeting for the first time. Like, fuck, these guys are sick. Whoa, this is insane. And Arco was there. You... Tobin probably, Mike Alcantar, me, and I think my friend Nick. And Nick was driving home, and we were kind of passed out, and all of a sudden he pulled the car over, the engine blew up.
Yep.
And we were outside of Sacramento. I believe it was like something Oak or something like whatever. Anyway, my car got left there. We all took the bus to San Francisco, and I left my camera in the car.
Oh, my God.
So all the photos from that
car. Fuck.
I was like, I
You're
don't care about
me.
The camera. It's the film.
You're kidding me.
I know. Oh, if anyone God. Out there found that roll of film,
wow.
I'll buy it.
Wow.
Yeah, but that was insane. But that was pretty much, I think, the beginning of
87.
Our relationship.
87.
And then we had a mini ramp in the back, and you would come down. And, and of course, me and Phil became friends, and Phil opened the door for me in ways I'll never be able to explain. But through all that, we got tighter and tighter, and then throughout all the years. But that day, people can't even believe when I tell them. I'm like, yeah, I was there. And people are like, no.
My recollection of it was we were skating this couch that was discarded in the back of the middle school. It was Everett Middle School on 17th and Church Street. And Tobin was there, myself, Mike McIntyre, Mickey, Julian, Arco, bunch of us just skating. And I don't remember coming from a contest there. I just remember being there skating that and shooting photos. And then we went out to the handrail in front of the school on Church Street, and Julian started doing frontside board slides down this little rail. And I shot a black and white sequence and a couple of color stills with a flash. Meanwhile, Tobin shot black and white, and Schmitty, unknown to me, shot, you know, sneaky eye. But it wasn't like, back then, it wasn't like, this is my photo shoot, or, you know, turn your phones off.
There was no Instagram.
It was just like dudes having fun and making shit happen.
Right.
And Julian made shit happen. We were there. And that's how it happened. So a lot of things in skateboarding were like that. It wasn't about, what trick did you get today? Or, you know, it wasn't a competition. It was just like, shit was just happening. And we happened to document it with our cameras. And thankfully, that's one of the best memories in my youth, of just being there. And half of photography is being there.
Right.
So we were there, and no one can take that away from us.
Julian didn't even know I was there. Like, I we were at a bar one night, and he was clowning me about something, and I was like, what do you mean? I was there when you did the front board. I didn't just show up today, like, you Johnny whatever. And he's like, you weren't there. I was like, I'll send you the photo tomorrow.
By the way, full disclosure, we used Schmitty's photo in the DVD copy of Sick Boys. You gave me the negative to scan.
Yeah.
I got it.
And then Sick Boys, how did that come about?
So
McIntyre.
This photo shoot we just spoke of at Everett Middle School with Julian was this hippie guy from Marin County used to hang out with us. He was a stoner, and he had, you know, a Super 8 camera, and he just asked me if he could film us. And there was no, like, I'm going to do a skate video. He just wanted to film us, and he was a surfer, and I said, sure. So often I would call Mike and say, hey, we're going to skate this spot or this spot, come meet us. So he'd show up in his VW bus, a yellow one, I remember it, and he would just document us skating wherever we went in the city. So if you go to Sick Boys video, you'll notice that all the parts are locations. And he went to Arizona with Julian and Mickey, and it's all location-based. Then towards the end of the film, Mike realized he had a lot of footage of Nodis. He went down to Venice Beach and hung out with Nodis quite a bit. So in Sick Boys, you have all these locations around San Francisco primarily, or the Bay Area, and then you have Nodis, who has a part at the end of the video. Because Nodis had the most footage, and he was such a groundbreaking skater. It was like, yeah, now Nodis should get the part. And then with the narration, we went up to Mike's studio and drank some wine and smoked some herb and did the first narration for the first 1,000 copies of the video. It sold out, and then we had to do another narration because he lost the audio, or we had to enhance the audio or something like that. So we had to go back in and do some more narration for the second pressing.
Was that ad-libbed or was it written?
All ad-libbed.
When you dig into a bowl of Wheaties.
Yeah, just totally watching the footage, stoned and drunk, and just heckling ourselves. That's what we were doing. MacDog Productions presents Sick Boys.
If you haven't seen this video, Sick Boys, get a copy. It's probably on YouTube or something.
Yeah, that's why
it was a huge inspiration for me. And if you're a NorCal resident and a skateboarder, you have to have it in your video collection. Absolutely.
Yeah. Shout out to Mike McIntyre.
Shout out.
Yeah. Mike came down to my house, and he was like, we were going to try to plan a premiere in the peninsula.
Rad.
And that was cool. Those times were like very exciting for me. Yeah. the part where you guys go to the hook
yep.
scared the shit out of not only me, lots of other people that have gone there even recently, like, is Bryce going to be pissed?
I don't own the hook, but I do keep it very close to my chest, and I don't let too many people know where it is.
Yeah.
It's just one of those spots, you know. You don't want things to be blown out.
Right.
So I'm sure... thousands of people have been there, but I'm not going to tell you where it's at.
Yeah. We have a very excited Tim McKenney on the phone. He heard you were coming in. Yeah.
No way.
And he's got a question for you.
Hey, what's up, BK? That's the question. What board did you like more? Your BK graffiti style board or the pointy notes gargoyle? Because even Schmitty just told me back. We all had one. He said he had a bunch. I probably had like three. Knock it off, bro.
Regarding the boards, I definitely like my Schmidt boards better than the Madrid boards. Just Paul is truly a professor and studies molds and how skateboards work and don't work and their strength points, constructions. And my first Schmidt board had an upturned nose, which gave me leverage on nose picks. And it was just a stronger board. It just those boards lasted forever. The other boards, they would break on just flying off a jump ramp or off a curb, a tall curb. So, yeah, Schmidt knew what he was doing and totally stood by him. And I was stoked to, you know, help him develop new molds and new products. So the gargoyle for the win.
Gargoyle for the win, Tim. And he wants one more question, Rebate.
Also, Bryce... your fondest memory of skating with my god, not as Coppice, whether it be in the city, Schraupen, Sick Boys style, CBS, or down south, shooting with him, shooting photos with him. That's it. Thank you so much.
I had plenty of great sessions with Nodis. There's a few that I can mention. One, we got to skate Stacy Peralta's mini ramp in his backyard up in the Hollywood Hills, which was really cool.
Mm.
And that was kind of new because a lot of people didn't have their own little mini ramps in their backyards. And that was like in 1988. I went down to LA to hang out with Nodis and start shooting his interview for Thrasher. So we went to Stacy's house and got to skate his ramp. Orb was there with us. Shout out, Orb.
Shout out.
And then we went to the Federal Building in Santa Monica. And Nodis, with copers on, because... there's a reason, but he had copers on both trucks, but he 50-50'd the Federal Building rails, which are super long and tall, as I remember. They're not steep. They're just long and sticky aluminum, so that's why he had the copers, but he hammered that out for his interview. It was amazing to see 50-50 go down on that rail. Nodis would always surprise you what he could do. One time at Studio 43, he showed up, and he was just blasting ollie to grabs, you know. It was like new back then. Tommy was doing them off of jump ramps, but on a mini ramp, it was like, wow. So fast forward a few years, and I had to tear Studio 43 out because the lease was up and the other people that contributed to the rent didn't want to do so. So we had to close Studio 43 down a year before the lease was up. I had to rent it out. But so I'm taking the mini ramp out, and I find all these cut up athletic socks with duct tape wrapped around them. They were Nodis's socks that he would cut off of his feet after every session at my ramp and stuff them under the flat bottom of my ramp.
No.
Thank you, Nodis. That was brilliant.
How did Studio 43 origin story, like...
It all started because, you know, street skating took over. So there's lots of street skating going on in San Francisco and the Bay Area, but we were lacking skate parks or ramps or anything with tranny at that point. We just didn't have a lot of places to ride ramps. I think HP was done by then. So this was end of 88. So I had been looking around for warehouse space. And Fausto had a guy who helped me out. And I found a warehouse space down on Marin Street, right across the canal, the channel over there off Army and 3rd. And I got this space for 3,600 square feet so it could house Fausto's cars and my mini ramp. And so Fausto would help pay rent, High Speed paid rent, and then Deluxe was starting up to help pay rent. and later on Think, you know, Street Corner helped pay rent. So we had enough money coming in where it wasn't all on me. I'd have to pay a portion of the rent and all the insurance.
Okay.
And then there were a number of keys, and everybody got to share on that. So we had a place to ride a mini ramp, night, day, whatever, all hours of the night. You know, it was great. There was no residential area near it, so we could blast music. That's where the Hell Ride started. Every Friday night after work, we'd go out there and have barbecues and skate the ramp. By then, we had a vert ramp attached to it, because Fausto said, if you guys get the wood, we'll build a vert ramp, and I'll take the cars out, but I'll still pay the rent.
Oh.
So we had a vert ramp for a year and a half.
Yeah. Dogtown video, right?
Yeah. And what else? There's like a James Kelch board release party there.
I think that, didn't they have Danny Way's Sody party?
Sody party for Danny Way. Yeah. Second one. Second Sody party at Studio 43.
That rules.
Yeah. So a lot of things happened there. It was really good for San Francisco skateboarding. Guys would come from the peninsula or other parts of California to come skate. Certain guys from San Jose never came up, but whatever. San Francisco didn't matter at that point to them. I'm not sure. They had Kennedy Warehouse. We had Studio 43. But no, it was great. Had a great time. We all really learned a lot of tricks, and it was cool, rain or shine. It lasted a total of 4 years.
4 years?
Yeah.
Fuck, that's killer. Yeah, and like good. The location, did you have, it's kind of on the border of like Gnarly and Dog Patch. So like, did you guys ever have any heat or anything?
We never had a problem. We never had anybody coming through to cause shit or break in.
Right.
There was never a problem with it. No, it was really cool.
I never had to go there.
Yeah. You never got to go?
Mm-mm.
Oh man.
I know. Yep. But I did get to go to Ray Myers ramp.
Okay.
And it ended up in my backyard.
No, that's where that ramp went.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a story about that one. Okay. So I was pretty instrumental in building Ray Myers ramp.
Uh-huh.
And I went away, I think to Europe or something like that on a trip, came back and Ray Myers said, we got to move my ramp, got to take it down. My parents are over it because this guy, Rory, who was a BMXer, friend of his brother, Maurice, put his cigarette butt out in the knot hole of the house, and the house caught on fire. So their dad was pissed.
Oh, yeah.
So the ramp had to go. So that became your ramp?
And then Larry from Ghostgate, because we would go, I think we had like a Wednesday or a Thursday, like you guys can skate it this day each, I don't know what it was. We were skating there kind of a lot. Like we had a day where we would just go there.
Remember there was a bowl that never got finished?
Yeah. Yeah. And somehow Larry talked to either Ray or his parents and was like, we'll take it. And then we just took it apart and brought it. Wow. And then it lasted at my house for less than probably 3 months because the neighbors called the police. They're like, blah, blah. And we spent like all this time. We bought new wood, as you do when you build ramps and stuff. And then it was like, are you fucking like, I was so livid. I was like, I'm going to learn so many tricks. Like, I got a ramp in my backyard. Yeah. Yeah, it was short-lived, but it was, I think I did learn Smith grinds on that ramp.
And so then after that, the crib ramp started.
Yeah, then. Like
a little bit later.
The Ray Meyer ramp went to my mom's when I still lived at home with my mom.
Okay.
Then I moved to Menlo Park with my friends. We had four of us, and we built, well, no, actually, even before that, Redwood City, they had a ramp, and those guys lived there, and that's where Phil and all of us kind of started really bonding.
Yep.
And then we all moved, four of us moved to Menlo Park and built that ramp with no neighbors.
Yep. Right off the freeway.
Yeah.
That was cool.
It would be so sick.
I remember watching Eric J. skate there.
Yeah.
I shot with him there, but.
Yeah.
Front blunts, and that guy had such board control and just so light on his feet.
He would always show up at 10 o'clock at night, and because we had lights, and he would just be like, hey man, I want to skate the ramp. You'd be like, all right. And he had a front blunt on that Zubox.
He did.
I think it was an indie ad maybe or something.
I can't remember. It was an ad.
Yeah.
And then I shot Carol there.
Oh yeah.
It's part of his
a Japan era.
Part
maybe?
Of his Saudi stuff. It was it was a Japan era, and then I think he did like an Ollie fakie too.
something like that.
And then I think Wade had a photo doing that, like either invert or egg.
How wide was that ramp?
It was wide, like 32 maybe.
It was wider than my ramp, I remember.
Yeah, it was so fun.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good times.
How you doing? I got a little bit more to ask you. Do you want to take a little break?
Hey, it's Matt D. at DLX Skate Shop, 1831 Market at Guerrero, as in Tommy. Come see us. Real, Antihero, Crooked, Thunder, Venture, Spitfire. We are here every day of the week except the big holidays. We've got a curb and we've got smiles on our faces. Come let us get you stoked.
And now for another First Impressions with Timothy Donald McKenney.
My first impression of the photography master, Bryce Knights, is a session with Pales, me, Dan, and Phil going to his spots. I believe they were kind of close to his house by the hill. Legend had it they were all marked on his wall on a big poster board, every one of Bryce's spots marked out. But it was a nice wall ride spot. Me and Pales were just reminiscing it last week at the B. The session was so epic. I remember Dan doing maybe switch wall ride 180s out. Remember there's a wall on the other side, ollie on the wall, bombing the hill, ollieing up, and doing a wall ride. It's all documented in Damage, the day with Bryce. There was also another spot where you ollie over a doorway onto a wall and goat rope off and bomb the hill. One of my favorite spots that I skated with him. Bryce Knights, you're a legend and a hero, and I love you, dude. I love your style.
Hey, it's Corey at Blue Plate, 3218 Mission Street. Come see us. Meatloaf, fried chicken, deviled eggs, Dollar Olympia beers. We're here every day of the week. We got a garden, and we got smiles on our faces. Come let us make you happy.
All right. Tony Farmer question. Who is Mr. Ballistic?
Wow. Is that me? Who is it?
I don't know.
Mr. Ballistic.
He said just ask you that.
Who's like, Mr. Ballistic? Wow. Could be Tony, man.
Huh.
That guy's like the calm cat, and then all of a sudden I've seen him blow up crazy before.
Oh.
Maybe he's referring to himself.
Yeah, we don't know.
It can't be me, because I'm calm, man.
Why did you choose Canon over Nikon?
Mainly because of the mag.
Really?
Yeah, so Fausto and KT, Mofo, all the gear at the mag was Canon at the time.
Okay.
I started with a Nikon.
Oh.
Yeah.
What was your first camera?
It was a Canon F body. My dad got me for my 6th grade graduation.
Huh.
And I carried that around with me for a couple of years. But then when I went to the mag, I got an AE-1, and I could use the lenses that the mag had. Which there wasn't a fisheye yet, but there was some wide angles and telephotos.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Mofo got the fisheye with the built-in filters, the 15mm 2.8. I was like, man, I got to get that. That lens is amazing. And I finally saved up enough to get that lens.
Huh.
But I always stuck with Canon. Yeah, then I went to the T90, which had the first 250th flash sync for daylight flash. Yeah, I've always stuck with Canon since. And
you still have
I'm
it.
On their program with Canon Professional Services. And some guys have gone to Sony, some of my better friends.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Shout out to Acosta. Shout out to Andy Kuno.
Shout out.
But I don't know if I can do the mirrorless stuff, man. I like the weight of a camera. A little light thing kind of freaks me out. But you just have to convince me or let me demo one, I think.
You got to shoot a hummingbird in low light.
Andy, you got that?
Yeah. Fuck. Have you ever left your camera anywhere?
No. I am always so good about my gear, and I've never had a problem.
Uh-huh.
You know the story about Dawes, right? Lance Dawes?
No, I don't know. I don't think
so. Okay, so Lance Dawes, a couple years into doing slap, he goes to Barcelona on a trip with a bunch of dudes. I don't remember what trip it was, but he goes to Barcelona, and he's there with his camera bag full of high-speed gear, and he sets the bag down next to him on a ledge, and he's watching the guys skate or whatever. He had just gotten to a spot. And he turns around 2 minutes later, bag's gone.
Oh.
Someone saw him, you know, maybe a couple dudes worked it, and they got the bag. Gone. Ghost. End of trip. Go back home. Yeah, so always keep your gear on your body, in front of your eyes. Don't be a kook.
Yeah.
It happens. I mean, I hear about cars getting smashed over at Potrero all the time. They leave their car or leave something in the car, go get something to eat or just... You can't do that. especially in an urban environment. There's people looking for that shit. So
that means you, Paul Shire.
Keep your gear close, man.
What about the no look through the viewfinder?
Okay. I'm glad you asked about this one. Here's the thing, and I'm not like saying you can never shoot without looking through the viewfinder. But when you're shooting an event with other photographers, elbow to elbow, and you're at the combi pool, or you're at the dew tour, wherever the fuck you're at, once you're not looking through the viewfinder and you're extending your arm with a fisheye on the fucking camera in front of the skater next to another photographer, guess what? You're blocking everybody else's shot. So what am I getting? I'm getting a photo with your fucking arm and a fucking fisheye lens in front of my face. It's bullshit. Keep your eye to the viewfinder right next to me. I'm not going to see you. If we're all shooting the same, you know, 15 millimeter viewpoint, we're not going to see each other. So don't kook it. That's all it is. But you, if you want to shoot without looking through the lens when you're not around a bunch of people, you want to bring the lens down to the tile underneath the coping, get creative, do it. Get weird, whatever. But just don't kook it at a contest.
Yeah.
Mofo will tell you otherwise. He'll say you can't ever do that. No, you can shoot without looking through the viewfinder. Just be cognizant of your other photographers trying to get work done too.
Right.
Because you don't own the fucking contest or the scene. You know, have some respect.
And if you got a GoPro on a stick, we don't need you even in the arena.
Just, you want to come up and get, you know, recognized for your good work? Learn to work with others.
All right. You've since moved to Oregon. Do you have a favorite park up there?
I've been in Oregon almost 13 years now. It's crazy how fast it goes. Now all my friends are there.
Yeah. Everyone's
Someone had to jump off the ledge first, I guess. You know, there's so many good parks up there. And I like to, like, tune out and get away from the crowds.
Right.
So I'll just go find little parks, like Tigard. Nobody goes to Tigard anymore. It's
no.
It's kind of just quiet. It's in the suburbs, you know, like, get weird.
Yeah.
Skate with the dinosaur, you know. You go to Glen Haven or even Burnside, for that matter, and things get crowded. You can go to Burnside at night or in the mornings, and it's fine.
What about Donald?
Donald's fun. It's a little more of a trek, but super fun. It's a backyard pool feel.
I love
it. Super fun. The only thing I don't like about Donald is that the deep end faces west. So you're in the evening, you're getting blasted by the sun.
Right.
It's hard to see the lip.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just an old man problem. It's not. The bowl is awesome. It's just the way it's orientated to the sun. It's kind of tough. Morning sessions.
If you and I ever, we've never flown together, I don't think.
No.
But if we did, it'd be a great tandem because you're team window seat and I'm team aisle seat.
This is true.
Is that so you can rest your head against the window and sleep?
Always. So I don't always have to get up and pee. I can pee before I get on the plane and I'll sleep for 6 hours or whatever. I can sleep on a plane no matter what.
Damn, so that's a good thing. So lucky.
So really good for international flights.
Hmm.
So, yes, I like to sleep against the window, the fuselage. If I'm in the aisle, I always get bumped by somebody walking down the aisle, my elbow or my shoulder, and it's just a drag. So I like to not be bothered.
Mm.
So I always take team window seat. I've been doing that hashtag since Instagram started.
Yeah, I love that one.
Yeah, as long as I have a window, a little hoodie so I can use it as a pillow, some headphones. Mm-hmm. I'm good.
Any other tips for the long flights, like besides sleeping? If you can't sleep, what you get a good book or do you listen to stuff?
Books are always good. If you're more in the business class area, then you always have power, so you don't have to worry about, you know, your phone draining.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have movies, you can do whatever you want. You have your computer.
Yeah.
But if you're stuck without power and you're in the back, I guess books are always good or magazines.
Okay. Let's play the name game and close it out.
Okay.
I'll say somebody's name and you say what comes to mind. Joe Lopes.
Funny motherfucker.
Mofo.
Motherfucker.
Tommy Guerrero.
Street chicken.
Rick Blackart.
Old Blackie.
Joe Fong.
Big brother.
Kevin Thatcher.
I owe everything to Kevin Thatcher.
Brian Brannon.
Bo Baba.
Jake Phelps.
Dedicated.
Eric Swenson.
The grease behind the wheels.
And Fausto Vitello.
My other father.
I'm so fucking stoked, like really honored to have you here. I was telling my girlfriend the other day, like growing up as a kid, you had the dream job in my eyes. Getting to meet you, you were the nicest guy and never gave me attitude. We became friends from a distance, and I got to do some really magical and rad shit because of you. Probably you're my KT. And to have you here is fucking sick. And just to be able to ask you lots of questions about this life that I've been at the mag for 20 years this year. So Jake's always given me a lot of information, whether I know if it's tainted or not. It's just I know you were there too, and I just appreciate you so much and stoked that you came in. Can we end on a crucifix song?
Crucifix song? Yeah, that would be good. Annihilation is a song that I wrote for Crucifix, so let's just play Annihilation.
Fuck yeah. Is there anything else we should mention?
No, I just want to thank everybody that's given me a chance in this life of skateboarding. I'm blessed to do it. Nothing was easy to get where I've been, and I'm thankful for everybody that's involved and really believes in skateboarding, because it really does save lives and opens up doors. So keep doing it. Keep skateboarding.
Absolutely. Cheers. Thank you guys all for tuning in, and big special thanks again to Bryce for being here. He has a lot going on in his life. He has many accolades, and I'm very privileged to have him in here, so big love. I'll see you guys next week. Bye.
From the human station, good one, man. Orange production for the benefit of a nation or its destruction. Power is power. It's the law of the land. Those who live for death will die by their own hands. Life is no ordeal if you can come to terms. Reject the system which dictates the norm. From dehumanization to orange production for the benefit of a nation or its destruction. It's your choice. Peace or annihilation. Annihilation is to all these to the end. After the end of war, the stream of death. Annihilation, annihilation, annihilation. The destruction, destruction, destruction. Streets are on fire. Death in our way, stars of a dream, bodies are laid. You go on preaching, religious dogma, while you are paying for its action. This is murder, annihilation, annihilation, annihilation. Great destruction, destruction, destruction. Streets are on fire, death in our way, stars of a dream, see this before. Annihilation is one, that means the end. I'm again, that war to end, I would see. Extreme event. You want the people laughing in their mouth. You wanna jump them, save your life. Annihilation, annihilation, just the day. Rapping after gonna blow your way.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Talkin' Schmidt. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Anchor, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. When you subscribe, you'll get notifications every Tuesday of new episodes the minute they become available. Also, please leave reviews and a 5-star rating. It's the best way to help the show grow up them charts. All the episodes will always remain free to my listeners, but if you'd like to help support the show, you can do so at our website, talkinschmidt.com, where you can pick up some merchandise like stickers, beanies, t-shirts, or hats. The website has an entire archive of all the episodes with extra photos and video. You can also email me with any concerns, questions, suggestions, comments, etc. at talkinschmidt@gmail.com. That's talkinschmidt, talkinschmidt @gmail.com. All interviews are conducted, edited, and produced by me, Schmitty. The intro music is Mary's Cross by the band Nature, and a special shout-out goes to my executive director, Cheryl Camisa.
Shout-out.
Love it!
Until next week, this is Talkin' Schmidt, where the Rolodex is deep, but the conversation is deeper.
Talkin' Schmidt. Talkin' Schmidt. Talkin' Schmidt.